Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Radio Havana Cuba, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We'll begin with France 24. We'll start with press reviews on Trump's developing war in South America, bringing a large military force ostensibly against drug traffickers. Then Angela Diffley interviews Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, who's from Northwestern University, about the changing approach from the United States in Latin America. He talks about the history of gunboat diplomacy in Venezuela in 1910 and new alliances with governments who are shifting to populist, anti-institutional leadership. Daniel calls it a contest of affinity. The more Trump-style you are, like Argentina and El Salvador, the more privileged your treatment. Those countries wishing to remain independent, like Colombia and Venezuela, are facing impositions of the 19th century. France 24.
Starting off with U.S. President Donald Trump's war on drugs with South America's cartels. It's intensifying, isn't it? What are the papers saying there?
Indeed, Stuart. So the Washington Post here says that Trump beats the drums of war for direct action in Venezuela. There are dozens of warships, planes, and thousands of U.S. troops newly deployed in the Caribbean Sea. And that's, of course, because the president declared an armed conflict with drug trafficking groups. The article here says that the U.S. president seems determined to start a new war. And some say that the ultimate goal is to topple Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. And the New York Times says that he is also expanding the operation. He struck boats in the Pacific. And Miami Herald here reports that after the Pacific, Trump threatened to expand the drug war to land. Trump's strikes have been described as extrajudicial killings, but the U.S. president says that he has the right to attack, calling it a national security issue.
Today, we're going to take a more in-depth look at how Donald Trump is trying to reshape some of Washington's relationships with Latin American countries. The U.S. has, of course, long taken a close interest in the events and the politics of Central America and South America, and Washington has a long history of backing coups in various countries as it attempts to either further its own interests or simply to try to stop problems in its, what it calls its backyard, ending up on U.S. territory. So to discuss all of this, I'm joined by Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, who is a specialist in this area at Northwestern University in Illinois in the United States. First of all, Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez, thank you so much for your time. Welcome to the program. I struggle where to start. Donald Trump openly meddles everywhere in this region. How do you think, for an overview, would you characterize Trump's approach to these countries? What are his motivations? Is this about stopping immigration, stopping drug imports to the U.S.? What is it all about?
Well, first of all, I think that you brought up, rightly so, the history of the U.S. as sort of the dominant player in the region. But what we're seeing right now is actually, I'd say, something that's quite new. There's almost sort of an axis of affinity that's being created or that's being nurtured by Washington, in which countries that are a little bit Trumpier in terms of their leadership. And by Trumpier, I mean, right-leaning, but also a little bit more populist, a little bit more conventionally anti-institutional, they tend to get a tremendously better treatment under this administration than under previous administrations, dating back really to probably the 19th century. You're talking about the Malays of this world who get bailouts in terms of their
Xavier Milei in Argentina.
Exactly. Or Ecuador's Noboa, who's getting additional security aid and understanding treatment in his own relations with the IMF, or El Salvador's Nayib Bukele, who has become a bit of a fixture in Washington circles and is seen by sort of the right in Latin America as kind of a cause célèbre in terms of his strong arm views on anti-crime. These are figures who are getting, contracts, they're getting bailouts, they're getting additional aid. But countries that sort of fall afoul of the United States are treated much worse than under previous administrations. And we're seeing that with Venezuela. We're seeing that to a certain degree with Colombia as of yesterday. We were seeing it for a while with Brazil when you had tariffs lodged against a major economy due to what their independent Supreme Court, decided in terms of former President Jair Bolsonaro, who is seen as sort of a Trumpy figure, being condemned for rebellion. So it's, I'd say it's a very different dynamic than really anything we've ever seen before. It's not about coercion. In the 19th century or the early 20th century, 1910, you had gunboats off the coast of Venezuela because former Venezuelan President Cipriano Castro had defaulted. They bombed Puerto Cabello, he paid up, they went away. This isn't that. There are gunboats off the coast of Venezuela now once again, but it's unclear what they want. There isn't something clear that Maduro could do, presumably short of stepping down, that would make that go away, because it's not about politics. It's nominally about anti-narcotics. And that's something that, can be declared a win at any time, but that also requires metrics. It's not binary. Which means that for the first time, really, the power of escalation is not in the hands of Latin American countries that may oppose the United States. It's in the hands of the United States, which is throwing a bit of a curveball for the Maduros and Cubas and Nicaraguas of this region.
I was going to ask you what Venezuela might do to push back, but you've already answered that. Perhaps we can look specifically at some of those countries you mentioned, starting with some in the non-Trumpy camp. Colombia, what are the specifics of that relationship between the US or between Donald Trump and Colombia? And how important is the drugs factor, which is resurging in Colombia, as I understand?
Quite important. The United States has stronger institutional ties to Colombia, really, than anywhere in the region, give or take Mexico, because of the trade element. Colombia has very strong collaboration in terms of security, in terms of anti-narcotics. It's been a big receptor of aid. A lot of those institutional relationships remain relatively strong. The issue right now is that the two presidents really do not get along. They're quite similar in terms of both Gustavo Petro and Trump. They are sort of communicators first, administrators second. They live very active lives on social media and very much in opposite camps. And they have a tendency to distract from domestic stories that may not be very flattering or useful politically by involving themselves or by, pushing sort of external stories, whether that be, Venezuela, Palestine. So they're quite similar in that regard, but they are at opposite ends. So a couple of weeks ago, you had essentially a decertification of Colombia as a partner in anti-narcotics, which comes with a price tag in terms of U.S. aid. But there was a one-year waiver that was granted to this, which basically at the time seemed like the United States didn't want to give up on those institutional relations, but they wanted to sort of put the country on notice. Colombia has an election next year. By the time that waiver ran out, you would probably have a new president. Gustavo Petro's not very popular. So it seemed like a bit of a forward bet on, if we can wait this out from the U.S.'s perspective. Now, because of some of the comments that Gustavo Petro has made in terms of both the gunboat diplomacy in terms of the sinking of some of the ships off the coast of Venezuela, one of which Petro claims had it was a Colombian fishing vessel. Also, some of the comments he probably, which was probably relevant, the comments that he made about Trump specifically when he was in New York that led to his visa being pulled, despite being the head of state of an allied country. That is something that seems to have changed that dynamic a bit. We're still waiting to see exactly how much there's going to be in terms of pain points for Colombia. You know, it's very difficult to cut all aid at once, even though that's what was announced by Trump on Truth Social. Some of these are multi-year contracts. Some of these have legal protections. Some of these have already been paid. So it's unclear how much it'll really damage. But symbolically, it is really, really different. And it's something that is really reshaping the region because smaller countries right now are really incentivized to prove that they are part of this axis of affinity. You know, you have to aspire. It's almost like a beauty contest. You have to aspire to be, in that Milei, Noboa, Bukele club. So if you are Panama, you are getting rid of the Chinese ports. If you are Paraguay, you are sort of changing recognition to Taiwan. If you are Dominican Republic, you know, these are, right, center-right countries, but they're countries that aren't really Trumpy in terms of tone and style. So they have to sort of give an extra pound of flesh in order to make sure that they're on the winning side. Other countries like Trinidad, which has been very much a partner to Venezuela on essentially anything having to do with oil or natural gas for more than a decade, is being forced to choose between being with the United States and being with Venezuela at a time when Venezuela is uniquely weak. So now you have a country that was very much sort of the junior varsity partner to Venezuela, helping the United States with some of these anti-narcotic logistics in the Caribbean. So you're basically, you're creating a binary choice. It's almost, if we look at sort of the old big stick diplomacy as having been coercive, this is not. This is actually a little bit more feudal. It's not about trying to make countries fear Washington. It's about trying to make countries be more like Washington. And as we hit an electoral supercycle over the next 15, 16 months, and Peru's going to have a new president, Colombia's going to have a new president, Chile's going to have a new president, that dynamic, that promise that you will get more by being Trumpier is something that we expect to have a lot of impact in terms of how second round runoff dynamics work, in terms of how primaries work, and the types of candidates who end up, representing the right.
I was just wondering, how do you think all this is working out for the United States? I'm thinking, Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico, he said, stop the illegal migrants coming in or I will hit you with huge tariffs. They did seem to reach some agreement. Broadly, how would you say this is working for the US, this Trump foreign policy on Latin America? We don't have a huge amount of time left.
Yeah, I'd say right now it's been tremendously successful from the U.S.'s perspective, so I can't imagine them abandoning course anytime in the near future. Basically, you're having a lot of the smaller countries that were in Venezuela's sphere of influence because of oil diplomacy for many years have now come very directly back into the fold. And it's something that is basically reshaping the dynamic so that you might end up with a sort of larger, U.S. sphere in which you have elites that are much more closely aligned to Washington in theory than even to some of their own people in their own country. It's almost a globalization of the US's backyard, but hemispherically defined. It's going well, and it's unclear really what is going to make them change course.
Daniel Landsberg Rodriguez there from Northwestern University with that very broad, big picture look at Trump in Central and South America. Thanks very much for that.
That press review and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The Colombian President Petro denies the Trump accusation that he is involved in drug trafficking and says that the Colombian military will not assist the U.S. in overthrowing Maduro in Venezuela. He accuses Trump of violating a free trade agreement between the nations, harming attempts to diversify agriculture in Colombia. Israel is continuing its raids in Gaza despite agreeing to a ceasefire. And in the West Bank, Israeli settlers made 71 attacks on Palestinians in the past week, beating them and driving them off their property. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Colombian President Gustavo Petro says that U.S. President Donald Trump falsely accuses him of being linked to drug trafficking because the Colombian army will not participate in an invasion of Venezuela during his term, calling it a senseless act to attack a sister nation. An interview with journalist Daniel Coriel, the president of Colombia, said, "It infuriates you, Mr. Trump, that I don't support the Americans and Colombian army in invading Venezuela." No, sir. What stupid Colombian would think of helping to invade where his cousin, his children, his 4 million Colombian people who live there, so they can be killed like in Gaza? The president of Colombia pointed out, "The same missiles that fall in Gaza fall in the Caribbean Sea near us," and that the president must speak with dignity and humanity, not just with his people. The president also criticized U.S. foreign policy, comparing current actions to historical violations of international law. The Colombian president also demanded the elimination of tariffs imposed by the Donald Trump administration on Colombian exports, arguing that they violate the free trade agreement in force between the two countries since 2012. Petro said, "Trump shouldn't have imposed any tariffs because there is an international free trade agreement between the United States and Colombia that he has now violated." In his conversation, his interview, he announced a meeting with U.S. Charge d'Affaires to address these tensions and a call for consultations with the Colombian ambassador in Washington, Daniel Garcia Peña, who he has recalled from Washington back to Bogota. "I'm not going to concede. I'm going to demand. Remove the 8% tariffs on exports. If we want to end cocaine, farmers must have access to fertile land," he said, proposing crop substitution with support from U.S. companies. Petro contrasted his experience with two U.S. administrations. He said, "I've spoken directly with former President Biden and through envoys with Trump. The attitudes have been very different. Decent with Biden, rude and ignorant with Trump." The president of Colombia said that the free trade agreement should have been negotiated with Colombian farmers. Had that been the case, the result would have been the end to drug trafficking, not to stimulate it. The free trade agreement was signed, millions of hectares planted with potatoes, corn, and other crops, and that has been ruined now, and cocaine production has increased. Regarding the anti-drug policy, he said, "What they have built from the anti-drug policy is a policy of domination over Colombia and Latin America. 1 million Latin Americans are killed, and the demand for cocaine hasn't decreased 1 gram in the United States, and the demand is also increasing in Europe." Israel is continuing its deadly attacks across the Gaza Strip, despite the ceasefire with Hamas that went into effect on October the 10th. Gaza health officials say that at least 13 Palestinians were killed, 8 others were wounded by Israeli gunfire over the past 24 hours. The killings came as the World Health Organization has now warned that as many as 170,000 Palestinians injured by Israel's assault on Gaza will need rehabilitation care and support for years to come, with some 42,000 facing life-changing injuries. In the occupied West Bank, the United Nations Humanitarian Affairs Office says it has documented 71 attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property just in the past week. Among the victims is a 55-year-old woman who was hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage after she was beaten unconscious by a masked Israeli settler wielding a club. Independent journalist Jasper Nathaniel, who filmed the violence being carried out against Palestinian olive farmers in the occupied West Bank, compared the Israeli settlers' attack to a lynch mob.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, like a subscriber in Cleveland did this week, PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Your donations are essential for the weekly production and distribution of this show, which I supply freely to more than 100 radio stations across the globe. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Israel released hundreds of Palestinian prisoners in exchange for hostages, and many of them were tortured while in Israeli prisons without being charged with crimes. An interview with Helena Sola Martin of the World Organization Against Torture. She discusses the Israeli policy of detention without charging and banning the International Red Cross from monitoring the 18,000 Palestinians they detained. The prisoners reported beatings, lack of food and medicine, humiliation and cruelty. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Now, in exchange for the returned hostages, Israel has released hundreds of Palestinians who had been detained in Israeli prisons. Many of them say they suffered abuse.
For hundreds of Palestinians released from Israeli prisons this month, coming home has been a mix of relief and devastation. Most were seized by Israeli troops during the Gaza ground offensive and held without charge, including Mohammed Abu Musa, a radiology technician who was taken in February last year.
They held us in the sports court without questioning us. I expected that there would be an investigation where they would try to understand and interrogate us. I thought that because this was an army entering a place, they would interrogate us and let us go.
Mohammed Abu Musa says he was abused by Israeli authorities while he was locked up.
The whole time we had to be on our knees as we were tortured. I will spare you the details. Beating with sticks, punching, humiliation, insults, threats to kill the family and similar things.
After he was finally released last week, Mohammed was told his mother, aunt, uncle, younger sister and her children were all killed in an Israeli airstrike in July. His account is not isolated. Many detainees have returned home to learn loved ones have been killed and have spoken of abuse behind bars. Human rights groups, the UN, and detainees have reported routine abuse in Israeli detention facilities, including beatings and insufficient food. Israel says it adheres to its prison standards under law and investigates any reports of violations.
And we are now joined by Helena Sola Martin from the World Organization Against Torture. That's a consortium of several NGOs. Helena, why does Israel detain so many Palestinians and not charge them with anything?
Well, Israel has detained, to provide some background, since October 2023, at least 18,500 Palestinians, including many women and many children. But these numbers are probably much higher. And they are indeed arrested without charge. They are arrested under different regimes. They are arrested under the unlawful combatants law in Gaza and also under administrative detention in the West Bank and under counterterrorism laws. We are very afraid, profoundly afraid and concerned regarding the lack of safeguards applying in all these different detention settings. For instance, detainees can be held without access to a lawyer for up to 75 days, especially those in Gaza or under the unlawful combatants law. And that's very problematic because there's no contact with families for most of them. So actually they are detained under incommunicado detention for months. And who knows actually what happens while they are in detention, because as you may know, Israel has banned access to the International Red Cross, to the ICRC, and also to any other monitoring body for all this period. So it's really very, very troublesome. And the reports that we receive, indeed, they are very, very worrying when it comes not only to what has already been described in terms of beatings or also the lack of the bare minimum in terms of access to food, to medical care, but there's a deliberate practice of cruelty and violence applied on a very systematic basis. So now that I was listening to these testimonies, the reports that we received are absolutely consistent with that.
Now, how much accountability is there for the treatment of detainees in Israel?
Unfortunately, there is not a single conviction of a soldier or any person within the Israeli prison system or the Israeli military system. Yet there's thousands of complaints that have been brought by members of our network, by many lawyers, but there's certainly very, very structural gaps when it comes to pursuing accountability, and there's a myriad of obstacles that makes accountability impossible. The problem is that, the needs are so tremendous that even if there's some limited organizations that provide this work, we would actually need to set up a much more, like a large-scale system to support all these persons that have, that went through these dire conditions of detention, and not only the conditions of detention, but also a systematic pattern and practices of torture and ill-treatment that may include dog attacks, solitary confinement for a very long period, threats of killing family members, sexual abuse and rape, including the insertion of objects in genitalia or private parts. So, and there is a long list of brutal practices that we have sadly documented.
Elena Sola there, from the World Organization Against Torture in Geneva. Thank you.
That interview and report was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as at YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary, as well as most podcast sites. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with a podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels, while I'm recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.